first, we didn't know each other the first time we met. We didn't realize the first time we met.
Whoa, that's right.
So
that was at Kim Hallbear's wedding.
Yeah.
In Minnesota at, what's the site? It's the site of the massacre.
Yeah, it's the site of a massacre at a powwow.
Yeah, it was a powwow. Yeah, I was playing the guitar.
I didn't remember that. But you danced really well, I think.
Okay, this class is about systems. For me, systems is mostly a bunch of boxes and arrows going around in circles. So I'm Paul Robbins. What a funky classroom. Like, there's this big pillar.
Yeah.
You guys, like, deliberately sit
there. There are people who sit behind the pillar, yes.
When they're lecturing.
All right. Well, my name's Paul Robbins. I am the director here at the Nelson Institute. But back before I became a mercilessly boring bureaucrat, I used to do research. So what I'm going to talk about is some research I've done most recently with some partners in India, and it's kind of System Z. And then I thought I'd just talk about how I got here. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Like how I got here. And it all goes back to 1988, before any of you were born. Is that right?
Some of them were born.
Okay, when were you born?
Okay, maybe not. Before all.
There's one person.
One person? Wonderful.
Okay. I was born in 88.
Okay. All right. So we'll go backwards in time at the end, but we'll start at the end and then we'll go back to the beginning in a sense, right? And we'll loop in a very systems way. So if I were to put you in a helicopter at the airport in Bangalore, India, in southern India, and we flew you west for about 20 minutes, and then I kicked you out of the airplane, assuming you did not die from crashing down below, you would fall into a rugged hill country with a lot of forests. This is a really forested area. It's one of the hot spots of biodiversity in all of Asia, and it is remarkable. So you're wandering around. This is my friend Ashwini Chhatri. You can wander around in this landscape. You see a lot of endemic species. That means species that are totally from that site only, very rare endemic species. You would see all kinds of weird wildlife meandering around. You would be in nature, it would be all very exciting. But statistically speaking, if you looked at your feet, if we just randomly dumped you anywhere in the hills, you looked at your feet, you were most likely to see this. Of all possible plants, this is what you'd see. What is it? What is it?
It's a honeysuckle.
Nope. Good guess, actually. Honeysuckle fruits in somewhat similar way. Any guesses?
You probably consumed some today.
That would be my guess. This is coffee. So the point I'm making here, right, is that if you're wandering around this landscape, it's got all this wild stuff in it. It's actually mostly private property owned by people growing coffee or arecanut. Arecanut is a nut that comes from a palm tree. You crush it. You chew it and you get high, right? Just a tiny bit, like a little buzz. And what else is in this landscape? Tea, rubber plantations. The point is, this is like a man-made place. So how does it function that it produces wildlife? Like how does what is the question you ask? How does the system work such that it can produce wildlife? And under what conditions does it not produce wildlife? When is it really bad? That's our question, that's our research question. So we got a National Science Foundation grant. These are my colleagues, Dr. Kriti Karanth and Dr. Ashwini Chhatri, and they work at the Indian School of Business and the Center for Wildlife Studies, because we gotta have both sides of this, right? You've got wildlife, but you've got these businesses. And the question is, how do they intersect, and what's the system that produces this wildlife? So you can see these production landscapes. This is tea production here in the region, and what are those? And the picture's not great.
Snuffleupagus.
It's elephants. So they're elephants. So this is like a wildlife and human landscape. It's incredibly complex. So it's a landscape mosaic made up of these sort of grasslands and forests and plantations. It's really structurally complex. Some species are going to do better than others in this kind of a place. The question is which and when. So this is the area I'm talking about. This is the so-called Western Ghats of India. Has anybody been to India? Does anybody want to go to India? There we go. You should go to India, okay? That's how it all started in 1988. So this is this belt of hills, right? And it's covered in forests, and it's really species rich. And it's also wet. This is the wet, dry line between the southwestern, this is annual rainfall. So on the coast, you get about 250 centimeters of rain. That's a pissing lot of rain. That's a bunch of rain. Like, it just rains, and everything rots. Like, your underarm hair rots, the food rots. It's really wet. It's a wet place. And then this is dry, so this is much drier on the interior. And these gaps, that's the hills, they run right on that line between those really heavy and light isohyets. That's really important, because that also contributes to biodiversity. So it's a complex system. There's a lot of stuff there. Don't worry about all the text. This is a repurposed presentation. That's what it looks like. You can see these sort of dense forest areas, and then these open grasslands. Really, it's staggeringly beautiful country to walk around in. So we studied Arauca and coffee and rubber. And what we did is we went out and we tried to figure out, like, where's the biodiversity, boxes and arrows. Where is there biodiversity and where is there not biodiversity? Like, some farms have it and some farms don't, right? So that's like science. You find things and then you compare them and then you test them. And then we asked ourselves, what is producing, where you get diversity, what's producing it? What in the landscape? The density of canopy or what's going in the input? What are the farmers doing where you get this? And then the question is, why do the farmers do what they do? Because farmers are not here to grow birds and frogs, right? They're here to grow coffee or whatever. They gotta make a living, right? They're selling stuff. So why would they manage the landscape in a way that accidentally produces the staggering biodiversity? And when don't they? So then we have to ask questions about how the farm works economically and what are the structural conditions under which the farmers have to make decisions. Because if farmers make bad decisions, they go out of business, they lose their land. This land has been in the family since the time of independence, 1947. That would be bad. Your dad would be really angry if you lost the family farm. Who comes from a family farm, please? This is Wisconsin. Nobody comes from a family farm. Everybody's from Milwaukee generation. Your second generation. If you lost the family farm, what would your dad say?
We're actually trying to get him to get rid of it.
So
actually probably nothing good.
Yeah, well, if you lost it, that's different than selling it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right? You have a total economic failure, you know, then you don't have any profits, nothing to show for getting rid of the farm. So I think the point here is nobody wants to screw up. So they're not here to worry about the birds, and yet sometimes they get birds, which is interesting. So we studied about 180 of these places, and then we surveyed about 1,000 farmers who live in this area on top of this 180. And what you do is you go out and you try to find, you have to count the birds and count the frogs, and then you kind of do these tests. So how did we do it? So this is kind of interesting. Birds are really interesting. You go, who's a birder? Does anybody like go watch birds? Does anybody do anything? What do you do in your spare time?
I'm in a band.
You're in a band, all right. That's good. What about you?
I go to concerts, houses for the people that I work with.
Okay, all right. So you don't have time for birds. Fine, I'll do it for you. If you need to count birds, what you do is you go at dawn and dusk to the same site 3 days in a row for 7-minute intervals, and the people who do this have to do it by ear. So most of you are listening for bird song. You have to be able to tell the difference between about 180 species of birds by ear. And then you confirm, hopefully, with a sighting, you don't always cite them, and then you record them, and then you know kind of what you saw there. And you do it on repeated days and times. So you have to do this over hundreds of sites over hundreds of days. So it's a really intensive operation, bird counting. And what do you learn? What we learned is this is a lot of, these are the interns who we used. That's a farmer who was very interested in what was going on over here. So they're out birding, there's 11 volunteers. It's hard work. While you're out there, you count other stuff. You know, you measure tree canopy and stuff like that. You do science. And what we found is lots of friggin' birds. There are so many birds in there. This is just the coffee plantations. Amazing. Some very ubiquitous birds you find everywhere. Some really interesting ones. It's the greater racket-tailed drongo. It's a great, it's a long tail, fantastic long tail. Some ubiquitous birds like the hill mynah you see everywhere, the Malamar barabut, not the best photo, but they're very colorful. The point, and the Asian paradise flycatcher, that is a spectacular bird. Why do we give a crap about birds? The reason we care about birds is actually their indicator that the ecosystem isn't dying, right? If you kill the ecosystem, you will not find birds or frogs. So they're indices. So if you care about the environment, and you want to measure whether it's doing well, a good way to do it is to count birds and frogs. That's why we're doing it. We're just trying to figure out how to save the Earth, okay? That's all. But we find birds. Lots of birds and coffee is the. And then what? How do you get those birds?
Where you have tree richness and tree density. I'm going to come back to that.
Meaning different kinds of trees and lots of them, right? And coffee is grown under trees. Why is that, do you think? There's two reasons. Why is coffee grown under trees? What do you think it is? Go.
Shade.
Yeah, the shade actually protects the coffee, especially the higher end of coffee's Arabica. The coffee you drank this morning, the coffee you're drinking right now is Arabica, probably. If you have that instant coffee, ground up right and then you put water on it, that is probably not Arabica. That's a more sun-tolerant kind of coffee. So the better coffees need a certain amount of shade, right? The second reason you keep a lot of shade, this is a hard one to kind of unravel, is that you can sell the trees. Duh. And for timber. And this is the thing about coffee, right? The price of coffee, you're not a coffee grower, but coffee prices, if you're a coffee grower, some days, they're like really, really good. What kind of farm is it? Dude. What kind of farm?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, it was, they just grew corn.
Corn, okay. Sometimes the price of corn is here, right? And sometimes it's in the toilet. And it goes like this, all right? That is what commodity prices do. But timber, nice and even, right? So if you're having a bad coffee here, you can always harvest trees. So that's an economic logic for keeping a certain number of trees on the land. So then we're gonna look for amphibians. So that's birds, we find lots of them, we find where we get lots of trees. Amphibians are even harder, right? You have to do this to count frogs. You have to be able to hear them, be able to distinguish 100 different kinds of frogs by ear. You have to do it in the middle of the night when they're out. You have to do it during the rainy season when it's pissing 250 centimeters of rain. And you have to do it walking up 45 degree hill slopes. That is why we have graduate students. Because I didn't do any of this. Do we find, and there's a sampling design, don't worry about that. You kind of have to walk these transects. Do we find frogs? Wow, did we find frogs? And this is such a good sign. Frogs are dying. Amphibians are disappearing all over the world. Now, maybe you don't care, but that's an indicator that the ecosystems are collapsing all over the world. Either because of climate change or because of change in hydrology. It's not good. When the frogs disappear, when you don't hear frogs, in a wet landscape like this, it means something has gone terribly wrong. Too many pesticides, the temperatures change, the rainfall regimes change. You want to find frogs. And we found lots of them. This is the gliding frog. This guy flies 10 feet in 1 leap. These photos were all taken by our students, by the way. You've got mucus-secreting frogs that manage their moisture loss during different seasons. You've got the smallest frog in India, known, that guy. This one is interesting. It was actually thought to be extinct, and it was rediscovered in 2000. We saw hundreds of these on some of these plantation properties. And then this is our pièce de résistance. This is a critically endangered species that's new to science as of 2008. And we find these, not out in wild nature, but like where farmers are. Okay, you following me? Like, there's nature and stuff, and it's in places, and there's reasons for it. Okay, don't worry about that. So let's just talk about just one relationship. Like, where do you get birds and coffee? And the answer is, you get the most avian diversity where you have the most tree species diversity. That is, different kinds of trees. So the property has not just lots of trees, but trees of different kinds, right? Some coffee plantations basically only have silver oak, which is non-indigenous species brought there by the British. Because it's really, like, it grows quickly and it's really straight, so it's good for timber. So you can imagine why you'd want to grow just that. But some farmers, for some reason, keep a lot of endemic tree variability, you know, in there. And when you get that, you get more. And canopy is the other one. So if you keep an open canopy, you're probably not growing Arabica, you're growing Robusta coffee, or you can have a much denser canopy, which is more expensive varieties of coffee, right? All right, and you can see also that this is a case of non-diversity here. This is all silver oak, whereas this has got like 31 different species of trees on it. The mean number of tree species is about 7, but this one has basically 2. So, what's the first thing we learn? Pretty easy. Where you get, this is the systems part. You get avian diversity, you get tree diversity. Now the question is, why would the farmer keep trees, lots of different trees? That seems like a pain in the butt, right? Why would you even bother to do that? So here's, we talked to 344 coffee growers out of that 1,000, and we asked them what they do and why they do it. And these, and the one thing that did not matter, what would you think would explain why someone would keep a lot of different kinds of trees on a property? If you had to explain that, like, just all common sense, what would you guess? Go ahead. They're an arborist. They're interested in trees. That's true to some degree. I mean, there's some people actually like the tree varieties, and they manage the trees, they like managing them. It's easier than getting rid of the trees is a really interesting argument. It turns out to be the reverse. Keeping the trees is incredibly labor intensive because you have to cut them back, coppice them, manage them. You basically have exactly the wrong answer, and you're exactly right. No, I mean, you're exactly right. That's what you should be thinking about. You should be thinking about labor. That is, so you are right. Even when you're wrong, you're right. Because farming is hard work, which is why you get out of it. And keeping a bunch of trees actually is really, really difficult. You need a lot of work to maintain all that variety. The less variety you have, the less labor is required. So you've actually just pulled the punchline. Congratulations. What is your name, sir?
Alex.
Alex. Well done. So we talk to these people. I'll tell you what doesn't matter. Education. This guy does not have a grade school education. This guy has a master's in horticulture. Okay? And then everything in between. That guy is not wearing his real hair. So we talked to these people, and one thing that did not correlate was education, right? So we counted trees on all these plantations and figured out what they were. So plantation size sort of matters, right? And when you grow Arabica, it matters. So if you're growing Arabica, you're more likely to keep this dense canopy and keep more diversity than if you're growing Robusta. Why would you grow Arabica? We'll come back to the labor question in a minute. Tends to have higher prices. This is price over a period in the early 08 to 13. You can see Arabica prices kind of go up and down. But when these prices get closer and closer to one another, it's easier to do the easy thing because you're not going to get more money back. It's easier to just flip over to Robusta and grow the cheaper coffee because the price difference isn't that much, and it's a lot easier to do. It's a lot easier to grow Robusta than Arabica. The cheap coffee is easier. So what we know is choosing Arabica is really important for tree diversity, and the size of the plantation, bigger plantations tend to keep more of these different kinds of trees. So we talked to them, and then we ran some statistics. And then we found out that there's a catch. If you have a large plantation and you grow Arabica, we're going to come back to Alex's point, it takes a lot more work. You need more laborers. So you need a lot more workers who actually have to live on the property, right? And we talked to these folks, and they all said the same thing. When they said that they were going to pull out the trees or simplify the landscape, go into Robusta, they all told us the same thing. The reason they did it is, and this is quoting, lazy workers, which means the workers wanted things like electricity, refrigerators, smoke breaks, right? They wanted like a living wage. They wanted to be treated as human beings. That's a big pain in the butt for the farmers. The farmers have been getting labor, essentially serfs who've lived on this property since the time of the British, to do all this work. And now the workers are like, no, we don't want that. We want more. So how is it, let me ask you a question, why are the workers suddenly having to get listened to? Because they've been asking for this stuff for 100 years. Why now, in 2010, when we did this study, 2020, why are farmers suddenly kind of have more muscle, no, sorry, workers have more muscle versus the farmers? Why do you think that is?
With the internet media, you can see what living and working conditions are like.
Great answer.
And then you can communicate what your conditions are like.
Great answer. Cultural aspirations have fundamentally changed. That people understand and see the world. They have lots of relatives living all around and outside the countryside. So that's one, cultural changes in India. Why else would farmers suddenly be actually being, not just asking, but getting their way? Why would they get their way? Why are wages going up? That's one reason, the aspiration, the demands themselves. What else? Why? Let's think about it. When wages go up, who's in economics? Is there anybody here taking an economics class? When do wages go up? Give me one good reason why wages go up.
Supply of labor.
That's right. When labor is scarce, wages go up. Because suddenly it's harder to find workers, and you have to give in to their demands. So their cultural aspirations change, but there's fewer of them. The truth is, they're running out of workers. In India, where there's more than 1.5 billion people, right? They're running out of workers. How is that even possible? How is that possible? The labor demands, right, are driving the respondent plantation side. There's some stuff about pesticides. I'm just leave that. And there we go. Permanent labor, 63% of the plantations we talked to had permanent labor. That's people who worked year-round on their farms. Those people are disappearing. You need those workers day in and day out. And the reason is, it's scarce and it can be highly specialized. This is arraca, this isn't coffee. This guy will climb up this tree in the morning. He's harvesting this stuff. This is a different crop. And he will come down in the afternoon. He literally swings, right, from tree to tree. He doesn't actually, his feet do not touch the ground for 6 hours. This is a very high demand labor job, right? I mean, this is sort of, you can't replace that really easily. If you look just at coffee picking, number of people in coffee picking, here is the daily wage rate for agricultural workers, and then in the state where we are, Karnataka, where the study is, and then the dotted line is the number of workers who are actually in the sector. And you can see it goes through the roof during a period in 2006. There's this increase in labor that keeps the wages down, and then it plateaus. And suddenly, it's harder to find workers. There's not a lot of new workers entering the system, so the price of labor goes up. Basic economics, thank you. What is your name?
Devin,
you should be an evil capitalist. You'd be really good at it.
That's the goal, man.
Congratulations. So, labor demands, where did all this agrarian labor go? Where are the workers go? Why are they disappearing?
Cities.
Cities. Urbanization. People are moving to Bangalore. One big factor. What else?
Leaving the country.
Leaving the country. Some go to the United Arab Emirates, working in oil fields. Yes? Where else are the workers going?
Higher paying jobs.
Higher paying jobs? Sometimes they go to the city even though the jobs are really crummy, but the work is really backbreaking. So there's something about the cultural expectations. So there's some higher paying jobs, some. Where else do you think the workers went? It's a trick question.
They died.
That's half of it. What's the other half? They didn't get born. The population of southern India is plummeting. The fertility rate in southern Indian states is under 2.1, which is the replacement rate. In other words, if two people die and two people get born, the population is steady. If two people die and three people get born, the population goes up. If two people die and one person gets born, the population goes down. And that is what has happened for three generations in Karnataka. And throughout all of southern India, the population is plummeting. The labor force is getting scarce. The price of wages goes up, right? The wages go up. The high demand, difficult management of the trees becomes more expensive. The choice then is to go into simpler systems of Robusta coffee, which opens up the canopy and decreases what? Birds and frogs. Where do birds and frogs come from? Birds and frogs come from cheap labor. That's systems thinking. Are you with me? How's that?
That's great.
Is that okay? So that's just crazy. And you know what's equally crazy from Crazy Town? Is that it is going on all over the world. Half of the countries in the world are under the replacement rate. The population of the world is going to level off in 2050. And then it's going to have to be robots. Because there's going to be labor shortages. And migration, of course, right? Because some places still have lots of labor. Like Nigeria has population growth. But other parts of Africa do not. They actually have a decline. You can expect to see places with labor surpluses sending workers to places where labor scarcity occurs. You know where there's labor scarcity nearby? The entire northern half of Wisconsin. Dairy farmers cannot get workers. It is very hard to get workers. They've been using migrant labor for the last 20, 25 years, and it's much harder to get migrant labor right now for a lot of reasons, right? So what are they doing?
Automation.
Robots. You can see robotic milkers. The cows do not get marched to the milking parlor. None of this means anything to you because none of you. You're from Wisconsin? Who's from Wisconsin? Who's been on a dairy farm? Set foot on a dairy farm, right? So generally, there's a milking parlor. So the cows are herded en masse in the middle of the night by a bunch of workers into this place and they get milked. It is there's some automation, but it's a pretty laborious process. When you got robots, check this out. I'm a cow. That's the robot. There's no people around, no workers. I just walk over here, She's just walking over here. Robot has a laser, reads the udder of the cow, knows it as an individual number, knows exactly who this is. It's number 274. Milks the cow. Cow's like, that feels good. Okay, let's get in. All right, I'm done. And she just goes back and goes and hangs out with her buddies. There's no workers. There's no nothing. It's like total wandering around townness. I've gone off topic. Has anybody ever seen this? There are robotic workers on this campus, actually. Yeah.
So the cow willingly,
yes,
in there?
You bet. They're bred for high levels of productivity. So it can get a little uncomfortable after 5 or 6 hours. So she just takes care of her own business. They actually line up, they queue up behind each other, take turns. Wow.
That's efficient.
It's super efficient. Leaving any question about whether they're more or less comfortable in this system aside, I can't get inside the head of a cow. But a more general point is, you're going through the great transition. You will all live in a time when the fertility rate hasn't been this low since before the Industrial Revolution. And the total population growth rate peaked in what year? Was the highest growth rate, that is the overall percentage growth rate of the human population, what year do you think that was? The year of the highest growth rate.
50s.
Good guess.
70s?
It's about 60 to 65. Somewhere around 65. So since then, it's been going. That does not mean the population is going down. The population is still going up, right? But the rate is falling off. So, go ahead.
I just want to add something. So we read stuff from Donella Meadows. Donella Meadows cut her teeth on thinking about systems at a time when the panic about population growth was at its peak. When was that? The late 60s, early 70s. That's when she wrote some of her first books on the crisis in natural resources being depleted and population growth and other things like that. That's how she got interested in systems thinking, is worrying about the growth of population and how that would affect natural resource use. But things change because they're complicated systems, and this is what's
really
happening now.
Really complicated systems, because you can now ask the question, why are people having fewer kids? Which is a really interesting question, because they are, and why is that? Guesses, ideas, other than Alex. Have I heard from you yet?
I don't think so.
Go.
Kids are expensive.
Kids are expensive. That's exactly right. Why did they not used to be expensive? I can tell you kids are expensive. I have a 2.5-year-old. Why are they expensive? Somebody I haven't heard from. Go.
We buy more of the products needed to raise a kid rather than producing ourselves.
That's correct. So you're no longer in an agrarian subsistence family. You actually have to purchase those things. Why else would fertility rates be falling? Yes, please.
More women go to college, start a family, or their life.
That's right. Deferral of births. My first child I had at age 50.
Contraception is becoming more widespread.
Absolutely widespread, and better women's health care in general, especially in southern India. Much better in southern India than in northern India, where you can see population is actually still, right, fertility is still high.
Demographic transition.
That's what this all is. What drives the demographic transition?
Industrialization.
Yes, but what's the mechanism? So how does industrialization cause a fertility change?
Well, because before industrialization, it's beneficial to have a bunch of kids because more than likely they won't survive. But after industrialization, health benefits,
yes,
more children will survive, so you don't have to have as many kids.
Right, so no need for the surplus, right? Two, you're out of the agrarian labor market where you need more kids to actually manage your land. But I think the most important piece is that women are employed. Because if they're employed, the opportunity costs of having a kid go way up. generally speaking. At least the time and space of births is much more extended. So the more autonomous women are in making their own decisions, the better health care they're receiving, on average, the fewer kids they're going to have. I'll come back to you in a second. How many kids are you going to have?
One or two?
Yeah.
One or two? Who's having zero? There you go. Who's having a big brood? You used to actually ask that question in class, and there were always people I want 8 kids. Okay. But you guys, this generation, I've been teaching for 30 years, so I've had time to see the demographic transition, right? I mean, the entirety, just the entire mindset of your generation is totally different. I was not going to have kids. I don't know what happened.
Can you go back to the map for a second?
Yeah.
Is more like,
I mean, I do know what happened.
Is there more urbanization in the northern part or the lower part?
It's an interesting point. Urbanization is pretty ubiquitous. So you're getting big cities everywhere. Arguably, some of the places that have had the demographic transition are less urban. You would think it'd be more urban because of the urban migration component of this, but it's not entirely, it doesn't correlate perfectly with urbanization. It basically, the perfect correlation is with women's education. If you put a women's education on the x-axis and fertility rate on the y-axis, you get an R squared that's like 0.98. I mean, it's just like, it's pretty straightforward. Okay, so then we write a bunch of papers because we're a bunch of geeky scientists. All right, so, and we start a coffee company called Wild Copy, where we take all the data that we're collecting, and then people pay essentially an upcharge for having coffee that protects wildlife. So that money can go back to the farmer, and the farmer can use a more labor-intensive system, or stay with Arabica at least. So in other words, you can now buy coffee from southern India. This is my partner, a scientist, started this company. So it's sort of an interesting offshoot of the work. The question is, how the hell did I get here? These are the lessons. Those are the lessons. Last one's the big one. What will baby bust? Tell your friends. This is how I got started. That's me. In 1988 in India. I went to India to become an archaeologist. I was trained, I got my degree here. I came from Colorado, and I moved to the University of Wisconsin to get an education in anthropology. I came here to go to a first grade university and to be where you guys are. Who's not from Wisconsin? That's incredible. You're way above the average, right? Because the rate is around 26 to 29% out of state. Name your states, just call them out.
Minnesota.
Illinois.
Connecticut.
What's that?
Connecticut.
Connecticut?
Connecticut.
You came the furthest. No, you came the furthest.
Indonesia.
You paid for it. That even beats Connecticut. Any other states?
California.
New Jersey? Okay. Is New Jersey further than Connecticut?
No. California might be.
California? Who's California? Yeah, oh yeah. What are you doing here? That's what if you kept asking me. I came from Colorado.
None of the UCs wanted me.
None of the UCs wanted you? It's not easy to get in here. Because you didn't get into Berkeley?
Oh, I didn't
want to go to Berkeley. All right, so what's that?
I'm from San Francisco, so.
Oh yeah, well, if you're from San Francisco, what you want is to get out of San Francisco. I get that. I like Oakland. I got family there. All right, so this is this guy in 1988. He comes here to study anthropology. He goes to India and to do archaeology, ethnoarchaeology. Mark Finlayer is still on the faculty here in the Department of Anthropology. He's a senior professor. I met a professor, and the professor said, okay, if you work really hard and do crappy work in my lab, then I'll take you to India on a free ride, paid for by the NSF. I totally went to India, because I was going to be an archaeologist. And you know what I learned? Archaeology sucks. So, for me, it did. I mean, I didn't want to dig things out of the ground. I just did. What you do in archaeology is you dig stuff, dig people's garbage out of the ground, and then you make up stories about them. That's archaeology in a nutshell. But I fell in love with India, absolutely fell in love with India, and what was going on there at the time. There I am, working on my beard. Definitely had a ways to go at that time. And the glasses, those have just got to go. And that was where I pooped for almost a year. Really bad. What I learned was that there are all these people doing interesting things. This guy's a herder. This was taken in the 80s. He herds his sheep, and what they do is they go on these huge migrations. And the timing of the migration is really interesting, right? You've got a herd of like 300 sheep, right? So in the dry season, they herd, well, in the wet season, when people are cropping, like, corn and stuff, they're growing stuff. They go on migrations out of the villages. They take hundreds of, and they go hundreds and hundreds of miles, thousands of miles. They go all the way around the country, right? Taking these animals around and get them out of town. And then when the dry season comes, and all of this is
stubble, they bring the animals back home and they graze the stubble. So there's a whole system to how the migration works, but it's really political, because every time they show up in a new village, they have to negotiate like rights to use the land. So this is just really interesting. It was a system, it worked, it was sort of ecologically sustainable, but it was complicated and it was political, and this, I fell in love with this way of thinking, whatever you call it. I didn't call it systems thinking at the time. Then I went on and did another project all about how these trees were invading. This is trees from that are endemic and indigenous to the southwestern United States, northern Mexico, Sonoran Desert. This is the mesquite, the Psammis truliflora tree. But when they got to India, they just went crazy. The British brought it in the 1800s. And they just became this incredibly invasive species. Names of invasive species in Wisconsin, please.
Eurasian milfoil.
What's that?
Eurasian milfoil.
Milfoil, buckthorn, zebra mussels.
Orange dotted bird.
Some orange dotted bird.
Mustard grass.
Garlic mustard.
So when these things get out of their home range, they go crazy, right? There's a whole system to this, and it's really complicated. So part of it is just natural. Buckthorn is just going to grow because it's aggressive, right? In this environment outside of its home range. These are these forests in the gray that are all new tree cover since 1986, and it's all one species. It's all Psammis truliflora. And then I was just interested in, like, why does this happen? It turns out to be really complicated. So as it turns out, when there's invasive coverage of this tree and it expands, the bureaucracies in the forest department feel better because their job is to make the landscape look greener, even if it's ecologically impoverished. So they meet the state tree cover goals, which is 30% for the country, and they either neglect or they plant juliflora, right? So the bureaucracies are part of the problem. And then there's the problem that because there's less for the sheep to eat, they tend to browse around seed pods of juliflora, and it's those scarify in the sheep's stomach, and they are redeposited as a nice little package of nutrients, and up comes a tree. So there's something about how the grazing works. There's something about how disturbance works. If there's less pastures to graze, there's increased grazing pressure, that tends to lead to forest disturbance, opens things up, and then the canopy of invasives can invade, and there's some other stuff up there. My point is, I kept coming around different questions, right? But all trying to think about the complex interactions that produce those effects. Here's a conservation area in India we worked in, a whole other project in the late 2000s. That's a reserve area, that's a farm in the foreground. This is what it looks like. It's fairly dense, and then kind of on the hilltops, or this is the dry season. And the question was, why do we get biodiversity here? So I asked the other questions, why do we get biodiversity, right, in a plantation? Here I'm asking the question, why do you get biodiversity in a protected area that's actually really heavily used by thousands and thousands of sheep and people are cutting trees? You shouldn't find all this biodiversity. That's the Indian wolf. This is one of the last breeding sites of the Indian wolf. And as it turns out, it's because the system doesn't work like it's supposed to. In theory, big things eat other things which eat plants, right? Basically, nature is a restaurant, right? So that's how it's supposed to work. And what's actually happening in this system is so nuts, is that a lot of the herbivores that are eaten by the predators are actually living on agricultural crops. They come in on the crop fields. And some of these indigenous species are actually using invasive species either as habitat or as food. So they're thriving, which gives the top dog and cat more to eat, including livestock. The sheep, they eat sheep. The wolves eat a lot of sheep, and obviously, because fairy tales. And the wolves also eat people wearing red, stuff like that.
But anyway,
they eat grandma. They eat livestock. Why don't the herders complain when the wolves eat their livestock in the forest? And the answer is because they're there illegally anyway. So they take it as a tax. It's just a small tax. If they lose a couple of sheep per 100 per year or per month, that's okay because they're actually, sheep reproduce really fast. My point here is that there's lots of wildlife for all the wrong reasons. And they have reasons to do with the way the system has changed. The system has entered a new state, which turns out to be productive of some things and not of others. So as it turns out, the panthers are doing very well and the wolves are not doing very well. Any guesses to why the panthers' numbers are going up and the wolf numbers are going down? Just guesses? You know the answer, actually. You actually know the answer from your own household. Dogs hate cats.
So the range of the panthers actually increases, the home range of the wolf decreases. They cannot cohabitate. They cannot live in the same range with one another. So dogs hate cats, come on people. It's like a rule of nature. Things eat things, dogs hate cats. Have you learned anything today? So it's about a system state changing and producing a different kind of outcome. This involved wandering around the forest with a GPS unit and counting trees and stuff. That is incredibly painful. And that is how I got here. Okay? Rob?
Yeah?
Did you get what you needed? Questions? Comments? Is it rude to ask how many kids you're gonna have? Is that considered a kind of invasive question? I'm serious, if so, I apologize.
In the context of the class?
It was in the context of the class.
But
it was educational. Nobody said eight. You can have eight, that's fine. I don't think population is a problem. It's just really interesting that nobody says eight anymore. No, none of the students I talked to.
So I have a question.
Rob?
Does any of this relate to your current job?
No. Okay, yes. So what do I do for a living? I run this institute, right, which offers the sustainability certificate, the environmental studies degree, the water resource management graduate program, the environmental resources graduate program, and the environmental conservation program, and the environmental observation and informatics program. And it's got a center for climatic research, and it's got a center for sustainability in the global environment, and it's got a center for culture, history, and environment. What does this mean? It means that this is one damn eclectic outfit. You've got people, there are people on the faculty here who have degrees in history, and there are people on the faculty here who have degrees in atmospheric science. And they have to somehow talk to one another to get everything done. Rob, what's your degree in?
Urban regional planning.
There you go. And not everybody wants to do that, and not everybody's very well equipped to do it. It's a very taxing effort. And all the projects that I showed you have two things in common. One, that they took place in India, and the other part is that they have big teams of really different people on them. There's economists, there's conservation biologists, there are people who understand hydrology, there are forestry people. It's a mix. And I just wrote a paper with a historian about the history of why India seems to want 33% forest cover. It's a really good story. We don't have time for it. But it was written with a historian. So that is what this has to do with my job, is that I took this job because getting all of that different kinds of thinking to the table is hurting a bunch of cats. Do you know this metaphor? I apologize if you're not from the US. We have a metaphor called herding cats. It's like herding sheep, except the cats. And cats don't herd as easily as sheep, right? They run every which way. Are you following me? So we say that about doing a difficult thing of bringing a bunch of people together. So you say herding cats. Is that a good answer?
It's your answer.
That is my answer. It's not a good answer.
No, it's a great answer.
That is why.
I want it to be your answer. I don't want to shape the...
And also because the other thing that this institute does that is different than just going out and doing a conservation biology degree is that, conservation biology is problem focused. Let's pick another one. Pick a non-applied ecological discipline.
Limnology
is applied. No, it's not.
Now if you talk to graduate students who left the program because it wasn't applied enough.
So the other thing is that this place, everybody here, all the PhD students, all the undergraduates, they want to make a difference. They actually want to put their knowledge to work. And these projects all have that in common. I'm really a bit of a theorist, so I don't want to solve problems at all. But I accidentally help people who do. So that's, I'm going to call on him in a minute. I just want to tell, okay, go ahead.
Well, why India? Like, what was...
I just totally fell in love with it. It's really interesting. I'll tell you why. There's you do things because this is how you write a grant. You do whatever it was you wanted to do in the first place, and then you come up with some scientific reason that that's the place you have to do. So this is what I'm going to do. I like India. I don't like India anymore. I don't want to get into this. I do like India. I have a love-hate relationship with India. But I did want to work in this system because the system is complex. And the other point that I believe we have to come to terms with is that there's no such thing as wilderness. There's wild things, but there's no place that is wild. Every place is humanized in some way. And India has been humanized for for 2 millennia. It's very hard to go to India and say, there's no human impact here. And that's helpful, because this is the future. India is the future. The future is a landscape where we have to have wild things thriving, we have to control catastrophic climate change, we have to do a lot of stuff. We have to have natural, all kinds of natural outcomes that are desirable, but we can't pretend that it won't be people doing it. It will be people that produce those outcomes. And if there's anything I've shown you in India, India is entirely produced by people. That doesn't mean it has to be pathological. It can be beautiful and have lots of wildlife, and it can be peaceful, and it can be economically vibrant sometimes. Sometimes it can be a real mess. But India is the future. Future is not, I don't want to say Wisconsin, it is not America. It is America, but America's going to look. America's already produced, except for large stretches in parts of the Mountain West. I'll give you that. But out here in Wisconsin, people have been working on this landscape for how long?
10,000
years. People have been managing this landscape, burning it, whatever else. It's like India. It's a produced environment. It's a great question, why India? That's the answer. I have done a lot of work that isn't in India. I've done work in near Yellowstone. I've done some work. I did some work in cities on mosquitoes and on turf grass. Why do people put pesticides on their lawns? Why do you think? To keep them green, obviously. But the issue there is that people who put pesticides on their lawns are more likely to say that pesticides are bad for the environment, their children, and the community, than people who do not put pesticides on their lawns.
Interesting.
So what does that prove? People are crazy. Okay, can I tell one more story, or are we done?
No, we go till 10:45, so you can tell all the stories you want.
Okay, I'm going to tell a story about life. Can I tell you a life story? So I applied to graduate school, and I got into some places, but I didn't get in with funding. And that was pretty disheartening, because I really wanted to do this stuff. It's pretty disheartening. So what did I do? I got in my car, and I toured the great roller coasters of America. There are some great roller coasters in America.
He's not kidding.
I lived out of my old Omega. I cut out the back seat so I could sleep in it. And I drove across the country going to roller coasters. Best roller coasters? Where are they?
Delaware.
Ohio.
Cedar Point, man. Cedar Point, Ohio. That's the best part of the country, no question. Kings Island's not bad. So, what's the point here? Oh, I'm halfway through the trip and I'm thinking, hey, why didn't I get money to go to graduate school? I'm pissed. I'm sleeping in my car. What the hell's going on? So I went out in the parking lot after I'd gotten out of the park. It must have been about 3 in the afternoon. And I got on a payphone. There were payphones back then. You would pick the receiver up. It was attached to a cord. And you put money into it. And it would make phone things happen. Crazy, huh? And I called the first one on my list, alphabetically. And I said, I'd like you to tell me why I didn't get into the grad program so that if I ever apply again, I can do a better job. And he said, can you be in Massachusetts in 2 days? And I said, I'm in my car. And somebody else had clearly turned them down, gone somewhere else, and a slot became open. And because I picked up that phone, I am here with you now. Had I not picked up that phone in the parking lot, you would be talking to somebody who's actually qualified. So that's a life lesson. What is that life lesson?
Stochastic processes are important systems.
Wow. I thought I would pick up the goddamn phone. Yeah.
It's also there.
So that's one life lesson. I'll give you another life lesson. So when I got out of graduate school, I couldn't get a job. It's hard. The job market in academia is really, really hard. It's really tight. It's hard to get. I mean, you can get a job, but it's getting a tenure track job or a good long-term stable contract of some kind is still really more difficult now than it was back then. Could not get a job to save my life. I was basically a visiting assistant professor. I was an adjunct. I taught 4-4 at the University of Iowa for a couple of years, desperately writing articles and trying to get an academic job. And I applied for one, and it was for social theory. But it was at Ohio State University. And the Ohio State University Department of Geography is entirely quantitative. Like, it's all high math, GIS, technical stuff. And here they're hiring in a really qualitative position. So I applied, and I got the interview, and I gave the talk, and they gave me the job. Why do you think I got the job when people who were better qualified in social theory did not?
Is there a cool story?
The cool story helps. What else did I do in my presentation?
Make connections.
Make connections. These are all good answers, qualitative kinds of answers. What else do you think I did in my presentation based on what I've told you? I ran a multivariate regression. I was the only social theorist who showed numbers in that presentation. Because the local culture there is sort of numerical, you know? They were quantitative sort of thinkers. And what that says, and because there was actually a multivariate regression in my dissertation, so it's not like I made it up, but I presented it. And they said, well, that's a social theorist we can live with because he speaks math. My point there is, if you want to succeed, I think you need as many skills as you can get your hands on. Like, it's important to be a specialist and be really good at something, but you need as many skills as you are at one of the best places in the world to get as many skills as you possibly can. Do not burrow down solely in one skill area. Who is an environmental studies major? So that means you're a double major, by definition. Which other major?
International studies.
Communications.
Okay, so take advantage of those other skills, because it's the skill that isn't the skill that is the one that will make the difference. Like the thing you're paid to do, you have to be good at. But it's because you can do something else that you're going to get that job, not because of what you're good at the one thing. Because everybody else who's applied for that job is also good at that one thing. You're also good at something else, that's going to be the difference maker. That will be what pulls you off of 4-4 teaching load at the University of Iowa. How's that? You got a systems lesson for me now?
They have to figure out what the systems lesson is.
What's the systems lesson? There is a systems lesson in there.
Oh. It doesn't.
Try all the interconnections. There are multiple routes from A to B. If you don't try the different routes, you're not actually going to get from A.
There you go.
Thank you. What's your name?
Matt.
Thank you. Questions for me? This is more fun than what I have to do to go back to, like write recommendation letters.
Yeah, I have a question. So when you're saying that in South India, the population is declining?
I'm saying the fertility rate is less than replacement, which means there are some parts that are still growing, but they're growing at a lower rate. And there are some places that have actually flattened. So a lot of rural counties, kind of tessels, have actually flattened.
So would you recommend in that particular area to increase the fertility rate, while in the larger context of the system, is actually fertility rate is higher than some part?
Yeah, well, right, on average. So you're taking averages over a spatial area. And fertility rate is really a model. It's not actually an actual number. I mean, it's a model of the average number of children that a woman will have over their reproductive life period. So it's kind of an abstract index. But it is true that there are parts of India that are definitely shrinking. In any case, the places that are growing at a slower rate, and then you tie urbanization to that, people moving out. So part of it is natural change, and part of course, is migration. So if you both have a topping out of the population rate and you have out migration, then you're actually going to have a shrinking population. Wisconsin population, growing or shrinking?
Shrinking.
Wisconsin population it's about level, but the northern half of the state is shrinking. Milwaukee and Madison and the urban corridor is growing, right? But the northern half of the state is actually shrinking. Kids are getting out of high school. Who's from Northern Wisconsin? Where are you from?
Rice Lake.
That's awesome.
Great place.
Okay, I love Northern Wisconsin. Are you gonna go back there to work? No. Who else is from Northern Wisconsin?
Where are you?
What's that?
Bainbridge.
Where is that?
Rice Lake.
Okay. Are you going back there to work?
No.
So Wisconsin's shrinking, which is interesting. So it's partly about the movement of people, and it's partly about the fact that this, right now, the high schools up north are they're consolidating, many of them, because they just can't hold enough kids. There's not enough kids to justify a whole school. So
they're trying to consolidate the school districts. It's really, really tough. And there's a real effort on the part of towns around the state to bring people back, have kids move back, have good lives. And in some places it's going to work. Some places are going to be great. They're going to be fine, nationally, if they feel. Some are not. Some are going to just keep shrinking. So it's a little uneven. And that's the same in India. I cannot speak for the current fertility rate in Southeast Asian countries. What's the fertility rate in Indonesia right now? Do you know? You don't know? Aren't you? What are you studying?
Yeah.
He's an ER PhD student.
Yeah, I think you should know the fertility rate.
Well, he's going to call me BSL. The way this is.
Yeah, so down from, right, a considerably higher number. Back in 1960, it was 6. So for 5.8. And now it's down here to 2.3. Malaysia's all the way down to 2.0. That's below the replacement rate. 2.1 is the replacement rate. The Philippines is still higher. By comparison. Just interesting. So as you've seen, it's everywhere. So Wisconsin is not unique. It's part of a global trend. Other questions? Comments? Does anybody want to do this for a living? What I do for a living? Not the being a director of an institute. That's really boring. I didn't get out of high school and say, I'm going to be the director of an institute. That was not the plan. I was going to be a playwright. Totally failed. You will never see any of my plays. They have been burned. Comments or questions?
You can pick one thing to ask about. You don't have to ask about everything.
Yeah, one thing. Go.
How old is your kid?
2.5.
Is that fun?
What's that?
Do you have fun?
Yes. I've never been to the zoo before. Now I'm there every Saturday. Totally into it. He's a hoot. He's insane. He's a nut. And he's giant. And at some point he didn't exist.
What? Real coffee drink though, you need great investigation.
Great question. You have to be. If you're gonna sit with these farmers, you have to drink their coffee. I don't drink that much coffee. I haven't had any coffee today. So yes, I'm a coffee drinker, and I'll tell you, having worked in northern India, which is really, it gets to be about 115 degrees in the summer, really brutal, right? I mean, incredibly different conditions to do work under. Frankly, for somebody raised in a temperate climate, it was physically very taxing. I found it socially and politically very difficult in northern India. It's the caste system where I was working, the Northwest is still active, meaning I had a research assistant who could not walk through the threshold of a door, because the person there was from the lead cast and it was not. That's how crazy, I mean, really intense cultural system, a shock system there. Southern India, man, you sit in a hammock, you drink coffee, you look at the palm trees. It's a much easier place to work. I love Southern India. Southern India is a breath of fresh air. It is also a place where women are the most highly educated, their labor force participation is highest. It's just a much more familiar kind of cultural landscape. For our U.S. citizen, for somebody from sort of American Anglo culture. So the answer to that is yes, coffee. Other questions, and then I'm going to be done. Go.
How'd you transition into the role that you're in now? Because you obviously wanted the job, despite saying before.
I did want this job. It's a long story. It's a very pretty typical way of getting into this. There are other people who get into it different ways. Because you give up a lot to take this job. You give up a lot of research, which is something I obviously love. I give up a lot of undergraduate teaching, which I really love. Except for grading, I hate grading. If I could have classes where I didn't have to do any grading, then I'd like teaching a lot more. You don't like getting grades, right? Why do we do it? Rob, why do we do it?
Because Baskin Hill wants us to measure whether or not we've met learning objectives.
Yeah, right. So there you go. So So the answer is you spend a career in research, and then you find yourself, I worked in land-grant universities almost exclusively, Ohio State, then University of Arizona, that's the land-grant, it's got the Ag School, and then here. And at Arizona, I sat in to be the chair of the department there
while the guy at the department on sabbatical. And what you realize when you come to chair of the department is everything you've been bitching about for years about how things are broken, you can actually fix them. It's like, wow, let's get rid of grades. You know, I can't do that actually, but you know, things that you don't like, you can actually get in there under the hood and you can fix. I found that really satisfying. I mean, it's harder for me to do my research because I'm busy doing that, but it made it way easier for everybody else to do their research, which is super cool. Like everybody else is doing better because I'm tinkering under the hood. That was pretty satisfying. And then this job got advertised. I had been chair of the department a few years down there in Arizona. And this thing got advertised. I thought, oh, Madison, Wisconsin, awesome, right? University of Wisconsin, my alma mater, place I have a deep dedication to. Bucky Badger, my son. When I ask him, who do I work with? Who do I work for? What does he say? Bucky Badger. So this seemed like pretty much a dream job. There are problems, I can tell you, problems about this job and about this institute. But for the most part, it's pretty awesome. And so that's how. So it wasn't like you planned for it. You don't plan for anything. We have a class called Careers in the Environment. We bring our alumni back. They tell their story about how they became whatever they are, you know, at the DNR or working for a company or whatever it is. And they will all tell you the same thing. They had no idea this is where they were going to be when they started. This and then this opportunity comes open, and you go there, and then oh, I learned a new skill, I could use it here, and then oh, wait a minute, this that looks like it's more fun, and then wait, I'm suddenly qualified for this. Who knew? And the next thing you know, you're in the job that you really like, but you didn't plan for, and that is typical. Ooh, that's been my experience. Systems lesson?
Yeah.
What is it?
I'm not going to. They have to tell me.
What is the systems lesson? I even know this one. You wind up somewhere because things are moving you there. It's not like you're planning. What is that? What do we call that?
Get the opportunity.
Get the opportunity.
Serendipity.
Serendipity? That makes it seem a little too random. Because like you're generating the skill, and then so there's something going on that's driving you in a direction, but it's not necessarily clear what that's called path dependency, it seems to me. Do we teach path dependency?
We talk about that.
So there's path dependency, there's things built into the system that tend to move in a direction, but without a specific outcome, right? Predetermined outcome.
And it seems like you're collecting a bunch of skills related to what you're interested in, and as you collect those skills, more opportunities are open, and then you get there and you collect more skills and discover more things you like, and it just never ends.
That's how it should be. That's how it should be for everybody. I hope it's that way for you because you took problems class.
And Molly.
And Molly's class. And who's getting the sustainability certificate? That population must be going up. How many certificate students do we have?
This many.
this is all of them?
Well, it's a lot of them.
It is a lot of them. We only started a couple years ago, so there used to be zero, so that's good news.
The revamp was annoying.
What's that?
The revamp was annoying.
Oh, you didn't like the revamp?
Oh, I was pretty much done with it.
You should be grandfathered out.
I tried to, it fell through.
He was pretty much done with it, but he hadn't registered yet. Said,
you can't grandfather you out if you're not in.
I was.
There's a systems lesson there. Yeah, everybody here should be an environmental studies major while they're at it. It's really easy to do. It's a second major. You can put it on top of the major you have. You got two. We got several triple majors.
We've had some quadruple majors.
No, shaking his head back there, like no way, Jose.
With engineering,
we have engineers.
It's hard to do with engineering, but you can get the certificate.
Yeah, the certificate. The sustainability certificate is not very good. Either that or environmental study. So it's just like no, getting out of here, or I hate the environment.
So
what's the reason you're shaking your head? Oh yeah, get the hell out of here. We don't want you here. You're a bad statistic.
You're a bad statistic.
There are lots of reasons to have a fifth year though. There are a lot of reasons. A lot of things happen, things that come out of your personal life. But I will say that the time of graduation for environmental studies majors, who are all double majors, is what do you think?
3 years?
Total time of graduation? I'd love that.
I would too.
Just asking to guess.
I'm sorry. I'd rather say it had to be inaccurate.
No, it's a good guess, actually. It's 3.9. It's below 4 years. So the mean time to graduation is actually below 4 years, and they're all double majors. So your guess is basically right. Once again, you're like Alex, you work forever. So you can get out in 4 years, unless something things happen. The mean time to graduation for the average UW student?
4.4.
I think it's 4.1. It's really good.
That's surprising.
It's really good. Percentage of students who graduate without debt, carrying any debt?
0.
2. 50%. Yeah, 50% of students graduate without debt. It is totally true.
Total.
Let me ask you another question. Percentage of those who graduate with debt that default on that debt over the course of their lives?
That's more than 3%.
It's less than 1%. But the mean nationwide is much higher. It's around 14%. Because, why is that? Because people got their degrees from places where they couldn't get a job afterwards because the quality of their degree was not the one that you're getting, which is the University of Wisconsin, which is why I came to work here.
That's a great place to end.
Fuck you, Badger.
But just give a hand for Paul. So we're wrapping up a little early, but that's totally cool. Next Tuesday, we will be talking about Paul. Because you get to be, you bring it, your presentation in, and then we deconstruct you.
Yes.
So, I see. Do you need a copy of it?
No. No, they have words of memory. Two other things. I already told you that the prompt for this week is up and ready. How many people have taken a chance to look at the video that I posted about how to do a presentation?